Welcome to the PR Moment podcast. Produced in association with the Marketeers Network.
This week on the PR Moment podcast, I'm interviewing Rachel Pendard, Managing Director of MediaZoo. MediaZoo, circa £40 million fee income and approximately 130 employees. It's an independent PR firm in London and it was co-founded by Rachel and Mark Killick in 2003. Before she founded MediaZoo, Rachel worked for the BBC and Channel 4 as a TV producer. First of all, as ever, a couple of plugs from me. Our PR analytics programme is coming up in a couple of weeks. We've got speakers from Facebook, Canagan Pet Food, the UK Government Communication Service and many more. And details are on the PR Moment homepage. And if you haven't seen it yet, we've just launched our new conference on the evolution of purpose, rebuilding trust in business. And we've got speakers from Roche, The Body Shop, ASICS, Nestle, amongst many more. And again, all the details on the PR Moment homepage. Finally, thanks so much to our PR Moment podcast sponsors, the PRCA. Rachel, welcome.
Hello.
Now, in the last 12 to 18 months, we've seen a number, I wouldn't say a lot, but a number of high-profile women leave their jobs at, frankly, pretty high-profile PR firms. This includes Frankie Kerr at Mischief, Rachel Friend at Weber Shandwick. Bibi Hilton has moved from UKMD at Golin to a global engagement director role for Unilever within the Interpublic group. And there are others. As a woman who's headed up a PR firm for, I think, about 16 years, something like that.
Yes,
tell me if I'm
right.
Wrong. Do you think that's a blip, or do you think there are lessons to be learned for the PR sector? I suppose in the environment it kind of creates for women in senior positions.
Obviously, I can't comment on any individual situations, but I do think when it comes to the PR industry, it's a game of two halves in terms of gender bias.
Okay.
66% of PR jobs are held by women, and yet just 39% of senior PR positions are held by women. So there is a gender bias skewing in favour of male members of the PR industry. What's more, there is still a significant gender pay gap in the PR industry. I think it's at about £10,000, the difference between the average PR employee salary for a woman and the average PR employee salary for a man. So I think it's certainly not all a negative picture, but we still have some way to go, definitely.
I suppose the disappointing thing as an observer is that we've had a bad, and again, completely taking out the personal elements of it, is that it wasn't that long ago when at least 50% of the big PR jobs in London were taken by females. And that's not the case now, is it?
I think it's a fascinating point that you make. There's a wonderful quote from Accenture that talks about how we send our daughters out into a workplace designed for their dads.
Mm.
And I do believe to a certain extent that that is still true. I don't think that your average workplace and certainly, you know, your average senior position, be that in PR or to be honest, in other industries, is necessarily that female friendly.
Okay.
I don't think we are where we need to be yet. But I think we're on a journey. And I think, you know, PR as an industry is still fairly well placed in comparison to others.
Yeah.
Obviously, the tech industry, for example.
But as a woman who's been at the head of a sizable PR firm for a long time, for a long period of time, what is it that you've done, I guess, you've learned to enable that gender equality at the top end of your business?
I think, in all honesty, I think there is a big difference for me. I'm not only a female MD of a PR firm, I'm an owner.
Right.
And I think there is a big difference.
You think that makes a big...
I think it makes a huge difference.
Yeah.
Because I'm playing by my own rules.
Okay.
And so I think that changes the dynamic.
What is it that you've benefited from to be a senior female leader that you think, I don't know about lessons for other firms within, but what is it that you feel been able to take advantage of?
I think when you're playing by your own rules, as I feel that I've been able to,
yeah.
I think that takes an awful lot of the stress and the pressure away. I think it's when you're having to conform to a structure created by somebody else that that's where stress, anxiety and pressure comes from. When you're setting your own targets, deciding your own vision, values, direction, all sorts of things, then you're dancing to your own tune. Inevitably, there are pressures. You know, you've got to pay the wage bill every month. But
that's normal business stuff.
That's normal
it?
Business yeah. stuff. Yeah. So I think, you know, I have a freedom that I don't think everybody in a similar position would have.
Okay. Now, you've recently won the Hera Award at the 2019 NatWest Every Woman Awards. Tell us a bit about that, first of all. But do you think it's more difficult to become a successful female entrepreneur than a male entrepreneur?
Yes, I do. Okay. I think it's much harder.
Okay.
Statistically, only 1 in 3 businesses in the UK at the moment are led by women. And I've got a son and a daughter. He is 3 times more likely to start his own company than she is, which I think is a tragedy, if nothing changes by the time they've grown up. When you look at female funding or funding that's available to women that want to start their own companies, it's a very bleak outlook. So just 8% of startup funding goes to women. And one of the most shocking statistics that I read recently was that you're more likely to attract funding in Saudi Arabia as a woman than you are in the UK.
Blimey.
Yes.
What do we put that down to? I mean, those are damning stats, right?
They're pretty damning. However, it's not a completely bleak picture. And I think that things...
Sounds pretty bleak to me.
No, but it's changing. And there's some pretty amazing people doing some amazing things.
It was 7% last year, was it? But come on.
Incredible things are happening which are changing the picture. First of all, the reason I think that award ceremonies such as the NatWest Every Woman Hero Award that I won, and it was the NatWest Every Woman Female Award ceremonies, are so important is that they show examples of strong women who are running businesses, yeah. role modelling entrepreneurship to the next generation of female entrepreneurs. So I think that's really, really important. I think if you can see her, you can be her. Okay. I really do. So I think, you know, certainly for me, there's an extraordinary lady who has just left the CEO role of Alexander Mann and become the chair person. And she's called Rosaline Blair, and she was on the judging panel for the Hera Award that I won. And seeing what she has achieved is so breathtaking and inspirational for me. And I think that just telling the stories of successful women itself is quite important. I also think that entrepreneurship itself needs a rebrand and a little bit of better PR. So I still think that there's an awful lot of baggage around the image that people have of the word entrepreneur. I think you still think about kind of, you know, men from the 80s, fast cars, greed, money, that kind of thing. And actually, I think that entrepreneurship is about creating job opportunities, solving some of society's greatest problems, innovation, helping people, you know, pay their mortgages, giving them opportunities to support their families. It's quite a noble thing, entrepreneurship. And I don't think that that's what people imagine or bring to mind when you talk about it.
Yeah. So I think about the personalities involved, and you're right, those tend to be men, males from the 80s, but that might be a sign of my age. But yeah, okay, that's
I think that too.
Yeah, okay.
And I want to have a different image of what an entrepreneur.
Now I think about you.
Thank you.
Okay. How can we encourage more female entrepreneurs, do you think?
Well, RBS, for example, has Alison Rose has just come out and pledged over £1 billion worth of funding to support the next generation of female entrepreneurs. I think that makes a big difference. I think
it's interesting, though, isn't it? I'll let you finish that in a minute. But so funding's, it's almost like stage two of the entrepreneur journey, isn't it? First of all, you've got to have the idea, then you've got to have the inner belief, or, and this is not a female thing, is it, or the desperation to need to do it. Do you know what I mean? Sometimes that's how these businesses come about, isn't it? And then you need the funding. So it's almost like that germ of an idea. Is it a mindset? I don't know. I get the funding definitely helps, but it's almost at stage a bit further down the line, isn't it?
It's a brilliant question. I think it starts at school when you have that careers chat and someone says, do you want to be a doctor, a lawyer, or a politician, or a chemist, or a journalist? And no one says, how about being an entrepreneur? How about making, you know, your own rules? What about starting your own business? And I think that it's incredibly important to talk to the next generation of young women about how entrepreneurship is actually an amazingly flexible way to earn a living, make your dreams come true, support your family. And it's a very, very valid choice.
I'm playing devil's advocate to an extent.
Yeah, fair enough.
Because I think it's an interesting conversation. I agree with that, that as a child, whatever, I didn't think, okay, I want to be an entrepreneur. But I thought that as a male. I suspect the girls in my class also thought the same. So at that stage, I don't think anybody thinks about being an entrepreneur, do they? But I do agree with your role model point. I'm sure that's really important. But there's a few things going on, isn't it? It's quite a complicated schema of things that are happening within that creating ambition, I suppose, within people and putting entrepreneurship out there as a potential career.
I think it's all about imagination and the stories that we tell ourselves and the stories that we tell each other. Okay. And I think if we're telling ourselves stories about amazing women who start businesses and achieve extraordinary things and we're sharing those stories, I think that becomes real for the next generation.
Okay.
I think it really is about role modelling is so important.
So your key themes, I suppose, to increase the number of female entrepreneurs are creating role models.
Yes.
Which, frankly, there are loads out there, aren't there? I mean, it's about bringing those to the fore. There's plenty of that we want more, but there's plenty of female entrepreneurs out there, aren't there? And then the funding you're saying is increasingly there to help.
I think it's changing, definitely. Okay. And I think when we talk about role models, I'm not just talking about super successful women that have made hundreds of millions of pounds. It's every type of female entrepreneur.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
It's not always about, being as big as you can possibly be. It's absolutely about following your dreams and your imagination and doing something that you love. So, yes, I think that's really important. And if we go back to the Rose Review, which I also think was quite a powerful piece of research, if we were to close the entrepreneurial gender gap, we would potentially add £250 billion to the UK economy in the next 10 years. So I think it's quite important to also...
What did you do? £250 billion.
So currently there are 1.1 million less businesses in the UK because of the entrepreneurial gender gap.
Wow. Just tell us about the Rose Report again. Give us some top line stats on that, because that's really clearly a really interesting piece of research.
So Alison Rose led the Rose Review and looking into why there are so many less female entrepreneurs in the UK than in other countries. So, for example, in the US...
Is that right? So we're really bad, are we?
We're not really bad, but the US is in a much better place. For example, female founders in the US still get a lot less investment capital, but there are a lot more of them just running smaller businesses. So it is quite marked in the UK.
I'm being unfair here because I didn't tee you up on this, so if you don't know, it's fair enough. But what's the percentage of female entrepreneurs in the UK versus the US?
So one in three female founders in the UK, and it's pretty 50-50 in the US.
Okay.
The difference is very marked when it comes to the value of the businesses that they run in the US.
Right.
And then it's there's a huge gap.
But it's 50-50 in terms of...
Closer to 50-50, yes, it is.
Sorry, go on. Yeah, you
say. So basically, the Rose Review looked into ways that we can help to close the entrepreneurial gender gap in this country. One of the very key things is funding, obviously. Role modelling is incredibly important. Talking to young women at the age at which they start making career choices.
When do we make career choices? So where do we need to... Are we talking primary school there, secondary school, university? It's all the above, I suppose, is it?
In all honesty, I think think there are the messages that we get of, you know, what a doctor looks like, what an entrepreneur looks like, what an ambulance driver might look like.
Yeah, so and there just are soak those, that up over our childhood.
Yeah,
and,
there's that. Yeah. But then I think in terms of the conversations that we're having, I think that's a secondary school thing.
Okay.
I would love it if every single female entrepreneur considered going back to her secondary school and talking about her experiences. So just telling the story. I think that's incredibly powerful, whether you've started a, you know, 100 million turnover company or a 50,000 turnover company that's just you know, indulging your imagination.
And where can people get more info on this? There's clearly loads of different websites out there with this sort of information on, but the Rose Report and that sort of stuff, if you recommend.
So for women that are thinking about starting their own businesses, I think all of the banks are doing some pretty amazing work in this area. So what I say to young women or women of all ages that come to me and say they're interested in starting their own company is go and see your bank before you do anything else. HSBC are doing some amazing things with She's the Business. RBS and NatWest are doing some phenomenal things in terms of inspiring the next generation of female entrepreneurs. One of the things that we did at MediaZoo was the Dream Bigger campaign, which encourages young women to think about their future, and that was funded by RBS and part of the.
And do you need to go in there with an idea, or can you just go in there and say, "I want to be an entrepreneur"? Or I mean, is because that's. There's always that pressure to have the idea, isn't there? And that's really quite a hard thing to do. And sometimes those ideas need to be developed. But do those sorts of schemes help you with that? From the germ to the actual manifestation of what it might look like?
I think you need to have an idea.
Okay.
Yes.
You've got to. Almost always, isn't it? That's the big jump, isn't it? To go. Because I have lots of ideas, and you know, you have to then sleep on them, don't you? And then, normally by that time, I've registered the domain or something, and then I sleep on them and go, oh dear, that's not such a good one.
But I think you've had some very good ideas.
I've had a few decent ones, but you know what I mean. For people out there, it can take a few ideas to have a good one, can't it? And that's
what. It can.
Yeah. So you don't get discouraged if that. I think in the UK, that's good. But that's a good, big difference, actually, between the conversation you'll have with a Brit compared to an American, is that don't worry about it, it's a bad idea. Just keep coming up with ideas. You only need one to make it, if you like.
Yes.
Fine. So just moving on to MediaZoo, which is, I mean, it's a fascinating tale. And don't take this the wrong way, it's a business that I've always been familiar with, but I didn't know you were as big as you were. And I think it's an interesting story to first of all how you started the business and then how you've grown it. Let's go back to the start. They go back to that entrepreneurial element. What made you decide? Because you had a proper job, inverted commas, at the time. What made you decide to gamble to an extent and set up your own business in what, 2003?
Yes. I mean, I think when it's very, very little and you're not earning a big salary, which I wasn't, it's much less of a gamble. I think these things become more of a gamble as you get older and you have a family to support. So it wasn't that much of a gamble.
But that's true. But at the time, I bet it didn't seem like that. Like because that's what I think, but I only think that in hindsight. Do you know, at the time, it's like, oh, I'm giving up this big job, a nice career, and I'm gambling. But I think at the time, there's always that great temptation with setting up your business that I'll do it after I've had another year's experience or another. So there's never that perfect moment, is there?
To be honest, for me, it was much more of a forced move. I'm very, very bad at doing what I'm told. I don't like following other people's rules. And I think they typically say that people that start their own businesses are incapable of being employed. They are the unemployable. And there's definitely an element of that for me. I really didn't enjoy filling in my expenses or being told what to do, where I could and couldn't film at the BBC. I really struggled with it.
You still have to fill in your expenses now, don't you? But or maybe not.
The accountant does that. I mean, you can. Yeah. And there's lots of amazing technology nowadays as well that tracks it for you. But it's different. So it wasn't much of a leap for me. I didn't enjoy being employed at all. And I found it very lonely being a freelancer, profoundly lonely. I didn't enjoy that. So what
How long were you a freelancer for? I can't remember.
Well, not that long, and I didn't enjoy it. Okay. I lived alone. I worked alone.
Yeah,
it was
tough.
So in all honesty, I wanted to be part of a tribe. I wanted to belong. But I didn't want to follow someone else's rules. Okay. So that's a...
Only gave you one option, really.
Pretty much.
Yeah. And you... go on, talk to us a bit about the genesis of the business, because it's quite an interesting start, wasn't it? It was... I like the way you... Frankly, you started as a... Well, go on, you pivoted after not very long. You tell the story.
So I was a television producer, and I... We started up, really, the name Media Zoo came about because I had this idea that there would be lots of different animals in the zoo. So there would be script writers and editors and journalists and storytellers and all sorts of different disciplines. And we would come together almost as a producers collective. So lots of different people working together, all probably taking one share in the company, up to 100 people.
Okay.
And...
It was going to be a democracy.
It was going to be. And nobody wanted to join.
Oh, really?
Except my old boss from the BBC, Mark Killick.
Yeah.
So he was the only person that was interested in actually working in that kind of way. So what was supposed to be a producers' collective and something that was quite democratic and alternative actually was just the two of us. And at the beginning, it was me... 19 days a month and him 2 days a month. So that was the beginning of the company,
But then you changed from a media production agency to become a PR firm.
Yes.
And after how long?
A couple of years.
Okay, so it's quite decent. And just briefly, tell us why that was. Go on.
So there's lots of reasons. So first of all, we made a big 40-part drama series for Channel 5 called Hanrahan Investigates, which was quite hardcore.
That passed me by, that one.
I think it passed everyone by. And Jonathan Powell, who was the creative director of BBC One at the time, he'd just left that role, but a dear friend of mine said that it was... the worst drama that he had ever seen in his entire career, which I thought I was almost proud of that. But we made Hanrahan. It was 400 actors, huge daily drama series. And we also made for Channel 5 some of Donal McIntyre's undercover shows. And I think there was a combination of... it being a little bit dangerous being out by yourself making undercover shows into criminal masterminds. When we'd been at the BBC and making shows like that, it was much safer because you have all that protection. You have 24-hour security if you need it. You have a legal team behind you. And obviously, we didn't have any of that when we were making shows for Channel 5. So there was that. But also, the industry was changing, and I definitely saw an opportunity to merge the experience that I'd had working on Watchdog with Anne Robinson and reputation management and understanding the damage that could be done to a business if that, a crisis wasn't handled well, with the potential of the explosion of video content. And I think there was just a unique moment in time, and it was a really good way, and I'm not articulating this very well, but there was a moment where... It was too dangerous, too scary, and too high stakes to stay in traditional broadcast. And there was a really exciting opportunity merging PR, reputation management, and digital and video content, which just felt like the right move.
And worked for your skill set and your knowledge and all that stuff. And you've built, as I said in my intro, you've built the Media Zoo to become £30 million business. 1-3, I should say.
Yes.
13.
I got a bit excited then.
Yeah, well, that would be all right. Which we'll come on to in a minute, just to talk about, where that sits in the sort of competitive set of independence in the UK and London. But, I mean, that's a massive achievement. I mean, I always think these things can come monopoly money if you're not careful. But if you just think about it in terms of account wins, 30 million's a lot, isn't it? You know what I mean? So how have you done it? I mean, it's quite a big beast, isn't it?
To answer your question, it does actually go back to this idea of entrepreneurship and freedom and your values. So the Media Zoo values, and one of the values that we hold dearest is we are entrepreneurs. So one of the ways you do it is you find amazing talent, people that you really, really believe in, and you set them free. Okay. So I don't like people, you know, boxing me in. And I think some of the best and brightest and most entrepreneurial people out there, they don't like it either. So for me, it is attracting some of the best talent and giving them a strong set of values that align with the values of the business. And then setting them free to be entrepreneurial within your organisation is incredibly important. It can't all come from one person. You can create the culture, you can create the values, but actually you have to have brilliant people to deliver those kind of numbers.
It's always an interesting proposition, I think, that the idea that to create an entrepreneurial culture within a business, and it can definitely be done, but it's a difficult thing to do, isn't it? Because you spent the first 10 minutes of this podcast talking about how you didn't want to work for anybody else, and as part of that was you being an entrepreneur and not wanting to be set free. But then to take those values and put that into an organisational structure within a business, it's quite difficult. I mean, it's loads of businesses do it, do you know what I mean? But it's quite a challenge. How did you go about doing that?
You find brilliant people and tell them that you'll back them, and when they have really great ideas, you, even if you don't completely understand and it's not your core skill set, you have faith and trust them.
Okay. Media Zoo's grown. I mean, it's not that there's another. The independents are having a great time, aren't they? PR agency wise. But it's certainly true to say that Media Zoo's grown larger than a lot of its independent peers. How do you think you've managed to grow to a £30 million fee income when lots of other agencies haven't? Because I'm sure they would say the same about hiring great people and
being really creative.
Exactly,
which
yeah.
is what everyone always says.
But you know, there's it does depend when they launched, don't get me wrong. So it's a sort of a sliding scale of time, if you like, but there's, I mean, just getting to £1-2 million fee income is a really hard thing to do, but you've got to 13, so that's, it does take some scalability, which you've obviously got and done that other people haven't.
I think the marrying together of our content engine proposition and the retained content engine proposition is quite key.
Okay.
I think the fact that, you know, lots of the people who work at Media Zoo are filmmakers and script writers, and we are very comfortable in production, which means that we can offer so many services to our clients and the value that comes with that. I also think, you know, what we learned from a 40-part drama series with 400 actors and only £26,000 an episode, which is extraordinary. You know, you think about, you know, a high-end drama will cost you £1 million an episode.
Really?
You know, so to do it for 26,000, even then, taught us an awful lot about creating content at volume and at price.
Like what? I mean, the mind boggles, but for example, what?
So I think where someone else might make a brand film for, I don't know, £25,000, we could probably create 200 video assets for the same budget.
Is that, and that's partly because you've got the skills in-house and the technology in-house, et cetera, et cetera?
Yes, okay. Everything in-house.
Okay.
So from animation to motion graphics, 3D, et cetera, et cetera. And I think there's a confidence. And I think.
And a volume.
And a volume.
Because you've got it, to have those things in house, you've got to be doing enough volume to use it, haven't you? That's the critical mass element.
Yeah. Okay. So I think that's been key.
But you've done it organically, right? You've never bought anyone, is that right?
It's such a good question. I would love to make a couple of strategic acquisitions, but I would love to. It hasn't happened.
Well, go on then, why? I know why, but go on.
Well, you know, there are two people that run Media Zoo and we have to be aligned.
Yeah.
So that's really important. We both have to be happy.
It's a tough thing to do, though, isn't it? I mean, I can see Mark's perspective. I don't know Mark. I should just put that in there.
But
there's there's plenty of acquisitions that look brilliant on paper, and then 6 months later, people have been going, "Oh my goodness!" So it's not it doesn't come without its risk, does it?
It definitely, and I think so much of running a business is your risk appetite, and I think that certainly as I've got older, my risk appetite has got greater, which is unusual. So I am excited by the prospect of the risk involved with making acquisitions. And, you know, I always have my eye on a couple. But, you know, timing has to be right, funding has to be right, it has to be the right opportunity, and there has to be a chemistry as well.
Yeah, it's a tough thing to do. I've seen... do you know what? I should write down... So start writing down, because people sort of tell me what's gone on, what hasn't. It's probably about 50-50 in terms of the ones that have worked and not worked, isn't it?
That's amazing. I mean, I think that's probably more than is traditionally...
You reckon?
Yeah.
I meant on the I should add to that. I meant on the micro acquisition.
Yes.
You know what I mean?
Yes.
So where you might go and buy, you've already got this, but let's say a digital team. You know, those are the ones that seem to be more
successful.
Popular is not the right phrase, but you know, there's a few. There's more volume of those happening within PR right now than, shall we say, the larger acquisitions of a whole PR firm. And I suppose conversely, you must have had some offers over the years, right?
Really a lot of offers, and more and more in recent times. I think, you know, probably one every couple of weeks for a good sort of 6 to 12 months last year.
And what do you do? Because, I mean, I get a bit scared when those sorts of things happen. It happens to you a lot more than it happens to me, but it's hard to know what to say, isn't it? I mean, what do you have a sort of a... do you now have a bunch of criteria that you think, okay, well, let's work out whether these guys are serious or not? Or do you just go, do you know what, my friend, I do not want to sell?
Well, I think you have to be interested in selling, otherwise there's no point in having the conversation.
Well, that's what I mean. Yeah. Maybe you don't have the conversation, but you have the conversation and work out whether it might be appropriate or not, is what you mean.
Yeah, or you don't bother having the conversation if you're not interested at all.
Yeah, okay. Now, partnership with Mark, how long have you two worked together?
Well, we've been in business together for 16 years. We've actually worked together for virtually my whole adult life.
It's amazing, isn't it? So, I mean, how long is that?
Over 20 years.
Wow. Mm-hmm. I'm always intrigued by that because it's... you can sort of start these business relationships having not known people particularly well, can you? And then obviously 20 years later, you know each other amazingly well.
Yes.
And quite often the genesis is the right phrase, but the start of these relationships can be quite informal, and then all of a sudden 25 years has gone past and you've launched a business together and grown a business together and here you are. Is that, how did that, I guess you didn't know how it was going to work out when you started, did you? Or did you, how did you to begin that journey and did you think you'd get to here? I mean, I guess you had a vague ambition to, but
I definitely didn't have an ambition to. I think it was a little hobby company. I mean, it was just, I don't want to work for anyone else. There was no plan to get here, that's
really?
For sure. And Mark had a job working for someone else. He only, he was media counsel for WPP. He was only working for MediaZoo a couple of days a month at the beginning. There's absolutely no way we could have afforded him.
Right. That's kind of cool, isn't it? So at what point did you work out that you're onto something?
To be honest, it grew incredibly slowly for a very long time.
Right.
And from my perspective, he'd
roughly 5 years, 10 years? When did it start scaling up, so to speak?
So my daughter's 11, and I think once I had my daughter, I had to take it a little bit more seriously, earning money. I think that became, I was a single parent, I had, you know, I needed to support my family.
Right. But that's it's been going...
That was, so she's 11.
It's been going 16 years, so after 5 years. Okay.
To be honest, I'd had to finish having her. So for me, it's really only been about 10 years of actually thinking, right, this has got to be something, this has got to pay the bills, this has to have focus and direction and passion and excitement.
Well, that's an amazing story. Well done. I suppose that's, congrats to that entrepreneurship element, actually. When did you, with that in mind, the whatever you just said, sort of 10 years or so, it's been you've had that eye on the growth or creating something scalable and big. When did you sort of had that stable feeling that it was all okay and it was a proper business, inverted commas, and everything was going to be all right? Or have you, or do you still have that? Because a lot of the entrepreneurs I speak to still have that fear that it's going to go terribly wrong one day. Do you still have that, or are you kind of, no, it's all right now?
So definitely thinking that you're going to have a panic attack on the way to work for a decade is definitely how I felt. And right. The pressure of paying the wage bill and knowing, you know, what was going out every month. Until you have a lot of retained work and you've literally got to make that every month. That is, you know, and I think my internal mantra for a very long time was, let's not go bust.
And
that's not how you build and scale a business.
No, it's not a bad.
That's not living in the faith and not the fear. But yeah. Definitely, what happened at some point is I just started to really love it, it started to become really exciting and really amazing, and the fear just fell away.
Really?
Yes.
So you, instead of seeing the dark side, you saw the positives. I don't want to make it too Jedi-esque, but is that?
I don't know what happened or why, but it has become just the most exciting, best thing in the world to come to work every day. Wow. And it can't... I think you can only be frightened for a decade.
And then you've got to let it go.
You just got to let it go.
Yeah, that's cool.
Yes.
And in the pre-show chat, you'd said MediaZoo has grown every year, which is quite a stat, right? 16 years later, that's remarkable.
Yes, yeah.
And again, but that's, talking to you, you seemed like it's, was that following some great strategy, or was it just basically just doing good work and the business grows? Is that?
From my perspective, certainly the last 5 to 6 years, we've had a very clear strategy in terms of growth, the areas that we want to be in, what we're going to do, how we're going to diversify. And I think... the business has been transformed by focus and direction and the values that we have as a company and understanding where we want to go.
Well, go on then. Tell me a bit about that. do you mean diversify within verticals or in terms of the different types of work you're doing for clients? What's the...
So I think that our content engine proposition and the embedded teams that we have or have put into organisations such as Santander will potentially change the entire makeup of MediaZoo. So, and I think that in the way that the recruitment industry was disrupted about 20 years ago, I think there is potential to disrupt the way content is created and sold. So I'm very excited by the proposition of putting embedded teams in to some of the clients that we work with.
So you have a client and... you're taking your expertise to produce content, mm-hmm. in essence, and but at some point the client is big enough to need that in-house, in essence.
Yes.
But they don't necessarily want to take the risk or have the skill sets to manage that content process,
yes.
internally. And so, in effect, you give them an animator, you give them a video person or a video editor or something like that to go and sit within their in-house team?
Copywriters, animators, scriptwriters, film producers,
and they
predators.
Might need that for 6 months, but they might not need it. It's a sort of semi-permanent thing, depending on how it all goes. Is that
6 to 12 men? Sorry, that was outrageous. 6 to 12 person teams,
okay.
typically, on 1 to 3 year contracts.
Okay. Wow, and that's happening right now, is it? You're already doing that?
Yes, and insourcing and outsourcing. So whether we have content retainer arrangements where quite simply we can produce a much higher quality and volume of content at a much more efficient price. Yeah. And also I think the people that work in those teams get to keep a level of creativity and excitement.
Yeah,
so they get
the
agency vibe. We can swap them in and out.
Yeah.
We keep the creativity high.
You do that, do you? You swap them in. So you might get the contract for 3 years. I'm making this up.
Yeah.
But it might be a different person after 18 months or 12 months, whatever, depending on the person, depending on the client, et cetera, et cetera.
If we need to, or the creativity is getting stale, or the client needs a different blend of talent,
yeah,
we can definitely swap people in and out. So I think... there is huge potential there, and I think...
And you've got the support of an agency which is important for the client and the people within that you put in the team to, I don't know, go and use whatever skills or processes you need back at the agency to do that piece of work or something.
Yeah, so you can expand the offer very quickly. And also I think I've been really excited by the potential of new markets. Obviously we have MediaZoo Scotland, we have MediaZoo Switzerland. I think it would be premature for us to expand into the US this year, but we certainly will the following year. So I think, and the opportunities presented in other territories are really exciting as well.
And what sort of verticals are we talking now? Just give us a flavour of the type of work that you guys do across different industries.
Explain a little bit what you more.
So is it a vertical? I know you work for INEOS, for example, but
yes.
what sort of is it? Do you have a big tech division? Is it on the consumer side? Is it more corporate work? What sort of...
INEOS is a really good example. So for INEOS, we do the most extraordinary range of things. So we're making behind-the-scenes long-form documentary about Sir Ben Ainslie's Challenge for the America's Cup, which is sponsored by INEOS. We ran the launch for Eliud Kipchoge's attempt to break the first sub 2-hour marathon in Vienna, which we launched.
He did it, didn't he?
He did it. Yeah.
I remember that sort of line thing he had to keep up
yes.
with. That was well done. Was that?
Okay. So, we launched that at the Roger Bannister running track in Oxford.
Okay.
So that was us.
So you're not sort of vertically focused. I get the feeling you're kind of taking it client by client and working out what they want. Is that?
Absolutely. So, we also work with INEOS right across the 21 different businesses within the INEOS family. Anything from, their acquisition of Bellstaff to Project Grenadier, which is their move into making a challenger to the Land Rover Defender. So it'll be, and that will be everything from PR, traditional PR, digital, video, even the kind of the graphic simulations of the car that doesn't yet exist.
Okay. Now, I did see it reported that you spent £5 million on a creative hub. Was it last year? I think that was last year. Was that... I get the investment in a creative hub, but £5 million? What, I'm just intrigued of what... Is that talent? Is that technology? Is that premises?
That's premises. Okay. So that's 10,000 square feet in Imperial Wharf. So we already have two buildings in Imperial Wharf. So we're creating a campus set up. So we have a TV studio, five edit suites in number 8. We've now purchased number 1, so it's 10,000 square feet, sort of double height ceilings on the River Thames. We're putting a TV studio and a further 7 edit suites into the basement. And then we've got space for about 100 staff in that building and about 60 in number 8 and 20 odd in number 15.
Wow. And that's done now. It's built and ready to roll.
2 out of 3 floors are built and ready to roll.
Goodness me.
So we're in 2/3 of it.
Wow.
Yes.
Just finally for me, just to bring it back to, I suppose, some lessons of your journey, so to speak. As it was, I think, for all of us at the time, 2008 financial crash, tough time. And I've had a few conversations with people recently that the people who think they're in the know anyway reckon that the economic indicators suggest that a recession may not be too far away. So with that in mind and history repeating itself, what was it that you did in about 2008 that meant the business survived? Because I know you said in a pre-show chat that it wasn't a business critical time. I don't want to give that impression, but it was a tough time for the business.
It was tough. I mean, I really do remember the phone didn't ring for about 2 months and what that felt like. It was absolutely horrendous. But I think you have to face into the challenge. And certainly with tough economic times, there are also opportunities. And certainly we bought our first office in 2008 and it was unbelievably cheap. And that has gone on to finance other parts of MediaZoo, right. So being able to borrow against that asset. So, if we'd
had... It's a really interesting lesson, isn't it? As you bought a bit of property and that's funded the expansion of the business, you know, to an extent, you've obviously had to do a good job on top of that.
But, yes. Yeah, okay. I mean, I think that can go either way for people, to be honest.
I've heard that story in reverse.
Yeah, absolutely. But for us, I think it was about having courage, facing into the opportunity, understanding that with contraction in some areas, there would be more opportunities. I think that will happen again. I think, you know, as certain industries contract, I think as people look for cheaper, more cost-efficient solutions, I think that we do provide a pretty competitive offer, and that sometimes does really well in difficult economic times.
Brilliant. Rachel Pendrett, Managing Director of MediaZoo, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the PR Moment podcast, produced in association with the Marketeers Network.
If you'd enjoyed the show, please do review us on iTunes and give us a decent rating.